Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, going to talk about what happened with Willie Taggart at Florida State. We're also going to continue our sideline series about booster culture in college football. We'll talk to Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society about that. But first, all right, so I want to be clear about something. I am one of those people who was skeptical of Lamar Jackson when he came into the NFL. But I also want to be clear, I was not one of those people who thought that Lamar Jackson was not a quarterback. Like, there's a lot of guys out here right now that's having to answer for coming out here and saying that Lamar Jackson should be playing wide receiver. Them old tweets is popping up fast by them dudes that thought Lamar Jackson should have been a wide receiver. I am not one of those people. My question about Lamar really hinged on arm strength as much as anything else. Arm strength and a certain measure of accuracy, but arm strength more than anything else. That and the fact that his build was just a bit slight. Like, that was where my skepticism was. I always thought that he was a quarterback, but I will tell you what I did not think. I did not think that he would wind up in a situation where a team would go all in on him and his style of play in the way that John Harbaugh and Baltimore have gone in on this. I also have some questions about whether or not you can keep using your quarterback like a running back or like a college option quarterback. I don't know how long that sort of thing is going to last, but damn it, while it's going, it is cracking. Cracking, I tell you, cracking. Gabe, you happen to see Lamar any what he did against the Patriots?
I saw him dancing into the end zone against the Patriots. That's what I saw.
Yo, so here's the thing about going against the Patriots. Whenever a young quarterback comes out there, I don't have the exact statistic, but we throw it out there about how poorly first and second year quarterbacks do against a Bill Belichick defense, right? How he typically manages to outsmart those guys, gives them more than they can handle when they're out there. That was not the case when it comes to the Ravens. Now, sure, you can make the argument that this is about a larger scheme and not about Lamar Jackson, except for the fact that the scheme is Lamar Jackson. Like, everything that they're doing, everything about the scheme that they're running is centered around the fact that they have the best athlete on the field when he's out there and he's got the ball in his hands. And when you see other players in the way that they talk about Lamar, opponents, teammates, whatever it is, I don't even necessarily know whether he's going to be some kind of Hall of Fame player, but I do know that he is already qualified for what I was talking about the other day, Gabe. Remember when I talked about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame players? He's already that dude, right? Like, there's always going to be some questions about a dude like that in terms of, like, what it's going to do for the larger team. Yeah, that's there, but there's something to be said for how blown away the dudes who play against him are. Like, after the Kansas City game, where Kansas City won that, one defensive player is there talking to media about him. The next thing you know, more of them are like, yo, you're talking about Lamar? And then everybody's just there like, yo, man, we ain't seen anything like this before. And the truth is that we haven't, or at the very least, we haven't seen somebody deployed in the way that he has been deployed. Like, I mean, I don't think that he's the caliber of talent that Michael Vick was. I think it helps him that he's taller than Michael Vick was, but I don't think he's the caliber of talent that Michael Vick was. We also never saw Michael Vick quite used in this way. Like, Michael Vick was never used in the run game as intentionally as Lamar is being used in Baltimore. What the big thing with Vick was, as much as anything else, was the threat of him on the bootleg, right? Like, you had to account for him in that, because they were running like a real West Coast kind of scheme at that point. You had to account for the fact that he's coming back the other way, right? Like, that makes life a whole lot easier for the running backs when everybody's scared to death that the quarterback is the biggest threat that's out there. But you didn't have Vick running between the tackles in the way that Lamar Jackson is, right? Like, it just wasn't that. The NFL offense, hell, college offenses, to be fair, had not gotten to a point where they are now to use a guy like Vic or a guy like Lamar Jackson. But hey, man, give Lamar all the credit in the world. See, one thing that you got to stop doing if you're one of these people that only evaluates quarterbacks by how they throw the ball, you got to recognize that you're part of the problem, right? And when I say that you're part of the problem, I mean the fact that we only care about the contributions that a quarterback makes in the running game when we want to. So, for example, I am wildly skeptical of Josh Allen. I don't think that thing is ever going to work out because I just think that he is such a poor passer. But there's no denying the fact that once they started really using his athleticism in the running game, their offense got better as a result. It made life easier for him as a passer, but you can't ignore his contributions in the run game. That being said, Buffalo's got a whole lot of fans that suddenly found Jesus when it comes to talking about Josh Allen in the run game when they could not find it when it came to Tyrod Taylor. A little weird about those sorts of things. Just a little strange. Just a little strange. But the reality is, the quarterback is the dude who takes the snaps. However you use him from there, he is still the quarterback. And what you don't have in Baltimore is a situation where you can just ignore the pass because all we're going to do is lock down on the run. Lamar going to burn you if that happens. And so he becomes the young guy that flummoxed the Patriots defense, no matter what it was. Again, if you want to say, well, you know, the scheme is something that they had not seen before and da-da-da. Okay, everybody else is running a scheme too. Maybe they should try to run this scheme, except they don't have the quarterback that can run this scheme. Right? This is a very particularly talented sort of player. Compare him to, say, Deshaun Watson. You can't use Watson the way that you use Lamar Jackson, right? Like, I feel like Watson's got the kind of athletic ability that allows you to put him on the move and makes him a more effective passer. But we're not really going to be in this situation in the NFL where you're going to do a lot of asking Deshaun Watson to take the snap from shotgun and then we're going to run an off-tackle play. You're not really getting that. He's not that guy, necessarily. Lamar is playing a different game there, and it is fascinating to watch. And let me tell you the other fascinating part about it when it comes to watching him. Lamar Jackson is like the least code-switching quarterback I've ever seen, at least the least code-switching black quarterback that I have ever seen. You go check out them interviews with him. Ain't nobody really trying too hard to polish that young man up. No, sirree, Bob. That's just how he talks. Right? He ain't really got to the point yet where he's putting on suits for press conferences. I recommend that he do that. Nothing wrong with looking good, but he's not that dude. And when it comes to him as a quarterback, unlike any other that I can think of, there doesn't seem to be a, we're going to make him a pocket passer push, right? Like that doesn't seem to be like an edict that is coming down from the top. And don't get me wrong. I do think for his long-term success, that the ability to play in the pocket is going to be important simply because the rules are in place to protect the pocket quarterback, right? Like that is a longer term play. What I don't think Jackson wants to wind up being is where it looks like Cam Newton is at this point at year 9 and you got a career arc that is that of a running back's because of the physical toll that you have taken. Lamar Jackson's carrying the ball a lot more than Cam Newton. Now, a difference is that Cam Newton runs the ball with power, and Lamar Jackson isn't really doing that and has done, I think, a pretty good job in the games that I have seen, at the very least, at avoiding taking those, like, giant hits. Like, he's not doing that. But this dude is this dude. And I want to see how this goes for the rest of the year. I'm curious to see if there's going to be a defense that makes some significant adjustment against this Ravens offense and then what the counterpunch is going to be that Greg Roman comes up with, right? What Lamar Jackson does as a result of people figuring out some things that they're doing right now. And look, we've seen some teams struggle when the counterpunch comes around. We've seen the Rams. It's taken them some time to get this figured out after the counterpunch came to them, which apparently was putting six-man lines up to make it so that their running game struggled. We want to see what the back end of that one is going to be, for example. You know, these are the things that happen. But I'm enjoying the hell out of this right now. And I hope that everybody else can and is getting shake off your this is or is not what a quarterback is. The quarterback is whatever the quarterback is when he takes that snap. And you got to recognize that. Now, Gabe, you've seen the rundown for the show.
I have.
Not everybody's seen the rundown for the show. It's going to be a little blackety black today. Just a little bit. I just want to make sure that you understand this because they're probably going to be sending us some stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's going to be a little blackety black. And I just want to tell you the blackety black thing that I want to mention right now when it comes to this. Football Outsiders has a metric called DVOA. You probably hear people talk about it a lot when they are referencing statistics. And DVOA is a catch-all for offense, defense, and special teams. It's hard to find something that gives you a really strong metric of how strong an offense is or is not performing, a defense is or is not performing. The way that DVOA works is what they're calculating is basically a team's performance per play relative to the line to gain. So like how you do versus first and 10 versus second and 8 versus third and 6 or whatever it is. And that becomes important. Like I remember Robert Griffin when he finally got back on the field with Washington, he would wind up with some pretty impressive counting statistics. But a lot of that came because they were winding up in like third and 12. And then he's throwing a 7-yard pass on third down because they're running cover three and they're giving up the space underneath. But that just counts as whatever it is. It was third and 15. You throw for 13 in front of the sticks because the team is giving you that throw. DVOA is intended to account for that. And so I'm looking now at the DVOA rankings going into week 9. So after week 8. So we don't have the ones from the week that just passed. After, let me just do this in terms of like full offensive rank going in. Number 1, the Cowboys. Number 2, the Chiefs. Number 3, the Seahawks. Number 4, the Packers. Number 5, the Vikings. Number 6, the Saints. Number 7, the Ravens. Number 8, the Raiders. Number 9, the Colts. Number 10, the 49ers. Number 11, the Jaguars. Number 12, the Texans. Okay. Here's what's interesting about that. The undefeated website here that we run at ESPN, about Black Bull stuff, undefeated.com. Check it out. They came into this year and referred to this as the year of the black quarterback. Of course, you had some people that wound up being upset about them saying that, but the notion of the black quarterback remains provocative, right? Like, you get a black dude as your quarterback and watch what happens. See how people pop up. See what the reactions are that people have to the idea of a black quarterback. It is still a thing. And I'm just telling you this right now. If you are hearing this and you are saying to yourself, I don't care if he's purple, you are probably part of the problem. Anybody that breaks out a color that ain't got nothing to do with what the hell we talk about, you ever notice that, Gabe? The guy that's like, I don't care if he's green.
There was this commercial. Have you seen the show This Is Us?
Yes.
I've never seen it, but there was a commercial where I'm not sure who the character is. This white father has a mustache, and he's got a black son that appears. Mm-hmm. He invokes the, I don't care if you're purple, whatever color. And, you know, I see you, and the son's like, well, then, Dad, you don't see me. And
right.
It was a commercial, but I just thought it was really powerful.
Yeah, that's the game that people play. And I understand the reason why people do it. The reason why people do it is because the idea of blackness is, like, by definition, negative in the way our society operates. Like, if you leave it on autopilot, blackness is a negative. So the way that people say that they are okay with black people is by saying, I don't even notice that he's black. Because if they do notice that he's black, then they go to the default setting, right? Like, I don't think that people realize that's why they're saying it, but that's the only way that this thing makes sense. But anyway, it's a big deal with quarterbacks still when a quarterback is black. And the undefeated deemed this as the year of the quarterback. I rattled off for you the top 12 teams on offense in per DVOA. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of those 12 are quarterback by black men. The other teams that have black quarterbacks that have started for the majority of the season are Tampa Bay, which is in there at 20 with Jameis. Actually, now that I look at this, that's everybody, because Haskins certainly doesn't qualify as being on this list. So we got 8 black quarterbacks in the league. That's 25% of the league. 7 of the top 12 are black. If we take this to passing offense, and by the way, that's also including the top 3 have black quarterbacks. We go to passing offense. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That is 5 of the top 11 are quarterback by black quarterbacks. 6 of the top 13 are quarterback by black quarterbacks. And then we get to Baltimore and Tampa Bay at 17 and 18, right? So Lamar Jackson's there at 17 in terms of passing offense per DVOA. Now, I am not saying this to somehow intimate that black quarterbacks are better than white ones, like not just by definition. That's not really how it works. It does speak to, however, the fact that for you to be the black quarterback, you got to be pretty damn good, because people are going to be looking for all kind of reasons for you to not be in that situation. But please recognize, man, next time we get a big-time black quarterback going in the draft, you're going to hear all the same stories. You're going to hear all the same code. You're going to hear all of those things in spite of quantifiable success. You will find people that will have these numbers directly in front of them and try to tell you why it is that they do not count. That's happened. And it will continue to happen. But please understand, you're fighting a ghost when you go out here and you try to attack and go too hard back and forth with these cats, man. These dudes are out here balling. And as in the year that the undefeated said was the year of the black quarterbacks are shining, man. Really, really shining. And I want to see how the NFL handles this down the line, because you can look at the television schedule, like the major games, the Sunday night games, the 4:30 afternoon game of the week or whatever it is, and the determining factors in who gets those primetime slots tend to be two things. It tends to be market size, and it tends to be the quarterback, right? The NFL has made quarterback stars. But the thing about the NFL that gets lost is they've been riding out the same names for a long time now. Like, we've been riding out with this Tom Brady thing for almost 20 years. We've been riding out with this Drew Brees thing for about 15 years. Like, those are the guys that they really like to put out there and they really like to showcase. Now, there's a game earlier this year that was the Chiefs and the Ravens. And I looked at the NFL and I was like, yo, man, you got two primetime young quarterbacks. You're wasting this putting this at a 1 o'clock game, man. This is a 4 o'clock game. This is a 4:20 game. This is a Sunday game. Like, this is a primetime matchup. And as we go down the line, these dudes, if they hold on to what they've been doing and the way they promoted these leagues, these dudes are going to be primetime, right? If they manage to maintain the level of success that they've had up to this point, these guys are going to be the ones in the league that we are looking at. And they're going to be those guys for a long time because these dudes that I listed for you are young. Right? Mahomes is in year three. Russell Wilson, not so much young. Prescott is in year four, I want to say. Brissett, I want to say, is in year four. Teddy Bridgewater, I put him on this list when I talked about this team's primarily led by black quarterbacks. Don't forget this with Teddy, man. You had cats out here saying Taysom Hill should have been the starter over Teddy Bridgewater, who had been a quarterback in the playoffs before. These are the dudes, man. These guys look like they're in a position to significantly affect the future of the NFL. And I'm here to tell you, baby, you better be ready. I sure as hell am. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about Willie Taggart getting the boot at Florida State. But first, one of the best aspects of ButcherBox is how convenient it is. A box of 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage breed pork, and more shipped right to your door. Doesn't get any easier than that. Thanksgiving's around the corner, and if you're hosting, things can get stressful. Well, ButcherBox can help. This holiday season, new customers can get a free turkey in their first box. That's right. ButcherBox is making the experience of cooking a Thanksgiving meal easier. Get your turkey delivered to your door instead of dealing with long lines and crowded aisles at the grocery store. And like their beef, chicken, salmon, pork, and scallops, you know the turkey you'll be serving for ButcherBox is humanely raised the way it's meant to be, with no added hormones or antibiotics ever. I love the meat I get from ButcherBox. Got some pork chops not too long ago. Threw them on the grill. They were fantastic. That was my favorite cut of meat in the box, in fact. So take some stress out of your schedule this holiday season. Sign up at ButcherBox.com/Bomani today and get a free Thanksgiving turkey plus $20 off your first box. That's ButcherBox.com/Bomani for a free Thanksgiving turkey plus $20 off your first box. ButcherBox.com/Bomani. Oh, boy, man. I had an interesting time in trying to talk about the Willie Taggart situation with people, because this is tricky. Florida State fired Willie Taggart after they looked bad again, and this time it was against Miami. A week before, the athletic director said, basically, for Willie to get fired, he's going to have to get hit by a bus. Apparently, that bus wore orange and green because he didn't have a job 1 week later. I question what they had to gain by firing the coach. Right now, if this was a team that was falling apart at the seams, like internally, locker room type stuff, then I would get it. I don't know if this is going to save their, well, the bowl streak is already over, but I don't know if this is going to save anything for them in making this play. But they went ahead and they decided to do it. And they fired a coach after 21 games. And they say they're trying to figure out the buyout, but you did this knowing that you might have to shell out $20, $21 million for a guy that you had coach for 21 games. Now, I have watched Florida State play a lot in the last 2 years. I understand why fans would want the coach of that team to be fired, right? I would understand why fans of that disorganized mess would not be happy with what they've seen. I would understand why they were skeptical of whether or not Taggart was going to be the guy to turn this thing around. Now, the counterpoint is this. If you have paid attention to Willie Taggart's coaching career, year three is when it gets cracking. Year three is when it got cracking at Western Kentucky. There were questions about whether he would make it through year two at South Florida. And halfway through, it got cracking, and then they went 10-2 in year three. Like, you knew who it was when you hired him. You knew that. And so to me, bailing before you get to year three, probably not the wisest move. Now, the counterpoint to that counterpoint, people weren't going to the games. Like, people had really stopped turning out. The morale level around the program was low. I don't know what it was in the building, but outside of it, it was not high. People were not pleased. They were not happy. That's the kind of thing that gets a coach fired. Got you. However, I made the point on Twitter soon as it was done. I did not find the firing to be indefensible. But it didn't sit right. And it didn't sit right. And it still doesn't sit right because of the way that they did this. I can't think of a guy to get fired during his second season without there being some like disciplinary impetus for such a move. I don't have it. Like, I've had people talk about going through and looking at these things. I don't see it. Like, this is very rare. And keep in mind, last Florida State home game, Willie's walking off the field and some fan, a win, by the way. They won this game. Willie's walking off the field and some guy comes down and says, and I quote, "Hey, Willie, you." That ain't about football. Now, again, that's just one person. So I don't want to extrapolate too much from that one person. But I'm just telling you, man, like, there was a level of anger and impatience and frustration surrounding Taggart and what was going on at Florida State that made you be like, I mean, like, yo, dog, I understand where y'all are coming from, but y'all extra mad right now. Like, y'all super mad. What's going on here, right? And I don't think that anybody could argue against the objective truth, man, that black coaches are not afforded the level of patience that white coaches are afforded. And even if you could argue that Taggart should have been fired in this run, you know, for what they had done in those 21 games, you would also have to acknowledge that this was an uncommon lack of patience that's been demonstrated in this case. I don't see how you could honestly say anything other than that. Like, two things can be true, that there's an argument for firing Willie Taggart, and damn, they sure did that really fast. But then, of course, everybody pop up. Because they say I called them racist. And I did not. I will say this, though. I think Willie Taggart wound up starting this off being behind the eight ball to a degree. Let me give you another example of somebody who wound up behind the eight ball in a very similar situation. Geno Smith got drafted by the Jets. Now, of course, that's never going to be a good thing for you. And I know where you guys are going. Oh, you're going to use Geno as your example. But hear me out. In the pre-draft process, we had the Nolan Naraki scouting report of Geno Smith that had all the code and it had all the dog whistle. Every single bit of it, top to bottom, had it all. Okay? At that moment, Geno Smith got branded as the black quarterback, right? And the black quarterback who was being picked on because he was black. Which seemed to be pretty clear from reading that, but there's a whole lot of y'all that get that, it hit you, that trigger go off right then and there when you hear somebody say something like that. And I am of the belief that that has colored the way that Geno Smith has been received for his entire career, right? Like, everything about him and the way that people see him, he was deemed and written off as a dude that never had a chance to be any good at that point. I want you to go, by the way, and check out Sam Darnold's performance this year and compare it to Geno Smith's performance as a rookie. Geno actually improved from rookie year to second year, and then he got his jaw broken and never went back. But you're not going to hear people bail on Sam Darnold the way they bailed on Geno Smith. And don't tell me it's because Sam Darnold was a first-round pick. Geno was taken in the damn second, right? Like, we're not talking about something that terribly different when we talk about these two dudes, right? But Geno got that branding, and I really do think that that colored in a lot of ways the way that people perceived his career and his talents and everything else after the fact. Hell, the Giants stuck around for an extra 2.5 years with Eli Manning just because how dare you do him the disservice of starting Geno Smith over him, even though the last few games we had seen Geno Smith play at that point, he'd been better than Eli Manning had been. But he always had that on him. When Willie Taggart got the job at Florida State, Mark Schlabaugh reported this. I'm not sure how many other people did, and I don't think I've ever seen this explicitly come out of the mouth of Stan Wilcox, the former athletic director. But Stan Wilcox, who was black, was the former athletic director. Schlabaugh reported that a big part of why Willie Taggart wanted to hire him was specifically because he wanted to hire a black coach. Like, he, Stan Wilcox, in the position of power that he was in, had a chance to do something to push the game forward a little bit, and he wanted to hire the first black head football coach at Florida State. Don't tell me about Haggins being that interim coach for that one game. You know what I'm saying. I guess it was two because they made the bowl, but you know what I'm saying. Like, that was what Stan wanted to do. Once you did that, man, Taggart was the black guy. Not just was he the black guy. He's the black guy, and it's being reported that being black is the reason that he got the job. And the last thing the white folks is out here trying to hear you talk about is somebody getting anything good for being black. Never, ever, ever. That is no, that is not the way this game is supposed to work. Dude, that was on Taggart as soon as he got the gig. And as soon as he got it, it was there. And then came a football team that didn't look very good. Then it came. So you put all these things together and you can say, yes, Taggart deserved to be fired. But you can also note the role that race plays when it comes in how we evaluate head coaching candidates or head coaches. So I made a, I did TV yesterday with Pablo, and Pablo made the point about, obviously, you know, that Florida State was getting beaten by all of their rivals. Jeremy Pruitt is at Tennessee. Jeremy Pruitt is in his second year. Tennessee won 5 games last year. This year, Tennessee is 4-5. They lost a game this year to Georgia State. They lost at home to BYU. By the way, they have already played. They're 4-5, and they played 7 games at home. Worth noting. Pruitt has 5 of his 9 wins. Let me see if I can do this off memory. Over Chattanooga, East Tennessee State, Charlotte, UAB, and UTEP. That's 5 of the 9 wins. Ain't nobody about to fire him. It's not about to happen. Scott Frost took over Nebraska at 4-8. Mike Riley had him there at 4-8. They went 4-8 last year. There's a good chance they might go 4-8 this year. Ain't nobody about to fire Scott Frost. It's not going to happen. Right? And now people have made the argument, well, it's different. Scott Frost won a national championship quarterback in Nebraska. That is true, but that also goes to the point, right? Right, he's one of theirs. They like him. They see him as their guy. Therefore, he can stick around. How much a chance you think Willie had at Florida State of these boosters seeing him as their guy? Like, do you realize how many coaches stick around for an extra year just because people don't want to pay the buyout yet? They got that money up pronto to get Willie out of there. Pronto to get him up out the paint. Now, if a white coach had been fired under these circumstances, would I make the argument that he should have been fired? Or could I make the case that he should have been fired? Absolutely. However, we will probably never find out if that's the case, because I don't think no white dude is going to get fired under these circumstances, right? Like, I wouldn't even really be saying what I'm saying to you now if they had fired him after the season. But I don't think a white dude in this, we're not going to be able to come up with a counterfactual. That's how crazy this is. Like, that's how wild and absurd it is that they did this in the way that they did, knowing that this gig was a massive cleanup. And everybody knew that this gig was a massive cleanup. Florida State, by the way, tried to get the word out in some ways that this was a massive cleanup. Matt Hayes of Bleacher Report wrote a long story about Willie Taggart. And one point they made is just how much things had atrophied under Jimbo Fisher. The offensive line play is a big thing that people point to. But behind the scenes, academically, things had gotten so poor that they were on the verge of one of them of getting like APR sanctions because things had gotten so bad. Like they had problems. There's no question that Florida State had problems and things that they needed to fix with their program. There's no way around that. I don't know how anybody can argue about this massive talent that Florida State had. If that's the case, why did they go 6-6 the last year that Jimbo was there? Like, we knew this thing was falling apart when he got there. That's part of why Jimbo bailed. And by the way, part of why Florida State wasn't sad to see him go, right? Like, all those things were there. All of those things were in place. And so for me, I'm not out here like broadly declaring that people are racist. I'm just telling you to peep game. Like, these are the things that move on autopilot, right? These are the things that people don't notice. And the reason is because you can make the argument for firing the coach. I say this about the NFL all the time. There are 32 teams. I can make an argument for firing 20 of the coaches on any given day. If I want to push the story in that direction, I can make an argument for firing about 20 of the coaches on any given day. It's just a matter of what your level of want to is. And see, that's the thing about firing when it comes to coaches. It's not about logic. It's about want to. Does somebody who matters want to fire you? It's not about your record. Your record can tie into the want to, but it's about want to. So Scott Frost in Nebraska, for example, they don't want to fire him for a number of reasons, but they don't want to fire him. And he's going to get every chance in the world to make that work up there because they don't want to fire him. You can go around to a bunch of these jobs. They don't want to do it. What happened to Taggart at the end of Florida State, by the way? The athletic director who hired him, not the athletic director that works there right now. The athletic director who hired him, if he's still there, unless the boosters came in and made some crazy ultimatum, because this is very clearly a booster decision that was made with Taggart. That last athletic director, Wilcox, Stan didn't want to fire him. Stan wouldn't want to fire him. He probably makes it through this year, right? Not so much because Stan's black, but because Stan's the guy who hired him. Firings go down based on want to. And so I made the counterpoint to people about Jeremy Pruitt, and they're like, hey, man, well, they won a couple games. It makes us think that, you know, those last couple games make us feel like this thing is getting turned around. They lost to Mississippi State with a coach who's not doing well in his second year, and they beat South Carolina. Those are the two wins we're talking about there. South Carolina fans won Muschamp up out the paint. Those are the two wins. Hey, man, think this thing might be turned around. Why? Want to. That's want to. Like, if you did not want that coach to succeed, then you would not look at that as turning around, right? And let me tell you how I know this in part. My favorite football team, the Texas Longhorns, has a coach that makes my ass itch. He annoys me greatly. And from what I can tell, he annoys everybody else, right? You know what that means? I ain't about to overrate nothing that he does. They went to the Sugar Bowl last year. They were a 4-loss team. Okay, right? I ain't got the want to try to make Tom Herman's wins look better. I don't have it. Like, I know how this goes, right? I know how this works. The want to with Willie was strong. The want to get him out of there was very, very strong. And even if you think that that had nothing to do with race, it's a fair question to ask. Sorry, guys. College football has not earned the benefit of the doubt. The question becomes, why are you personally so defensive about it when you didn't make the decision? Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody hit the dog and the dog went, hoo, hoo, hoo. All right, we are continuing our sideline series here. We're talking about college football booster culture. We're doing this in conjunction with Banner Society over at SB Nation. We talked to Spencer Hall of Banner Society for our first installment. Then we talked to Marcus Spears of ESPN. And now we're going to talk to Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society. A couple years ago, you wrote a fascinating story about the bag man, college football. And the bag man is basically the dude whose job it is to deliver whatever inducements, shall we say, are there to be delivered to get a college player to go to a particular school. And we are talking about things that you're not supposed to do, but you know, it's life.
It's the kind of recruiting we're not supposed to be talking about, period.
Yes,
right?
But it's, of course, the most fun stuff.
Oh,
right?
Of course. Yeah.
It's the whole reason why we're here.
When all these coaches say that there's, you know, they're great recruiters, right? They get awards for this. The Broyles Award, you know, this always goes to guys who are like, well, he's always been historically a great recruiter. You know, that just happens on their own, right? That's just the charm in the living room. Not anything to do with anything else.
I was talking to somebody about the University of Houston the other day. And I would actually, the more I think about it, I kind of want to write a book about this, even though I'm not qualified. And the reason is, Houston was at the forefront of integration in football in the South. They were at the forefront of integration in basketball in the South. And were at the forefront of cheating of football in the 1980s with your legendary head coach actually handing out envelopes in the locker room after games. Why? Because they want it that bad.
It's one of my favorite universities in all of college sports because not only is all that true, they are ridiculously, confidently transparent about all of it. And you don't get that anywhere. Like, they wear it on their chest. It's one of my favorite places to go to because obviously right now they're outside of the Power Five.
Right.
They have this one mega booster, the guy who owns the Rockets. No one acts like Houston does, man. I don't know if that's a Texas thing or if it's that sort of like southeastern mix that you get in that city, but They're beautiful about it, man.
Well, the thing is,
they'll tell you the score.
Well, the thing is, they're as big as UT and as A&M is, right?
Oh,
except
doubt,
they're
yeah.
not them. Like, they are the one when it's like, who are we keeping out of this? Who are we keeping out of the major conference, right? TCU? No, we'll go ahead and let you in. That's not such a big deal. Houston is the one that scares them every time.
You've been to those two campuses, though. You start to understand why. There's a lot of coding going on. And again, that's another reason, you know, on a less humorous note, that I like Houston is they will tell you that, too. They
yes.
will tell you the perceptions against it, that they were a commuter school. They had large minority populations before that was a thing you did.
Right.
They are indicative of, I think, one of those schools that suffered the most from suburban white flights.
Yes.
25, 30-ish years ago, where you see, it's kind of funny now, all these schools on the outside, all city schools, right?
Yes.
Almost all those city schools have been pushed out. That's why, like, I look at Louisville and I think it's a miracle.
It really is.
They put together some plans, let's say, to accelerate in a lot of ways, because when you got tagged with urban campus, it was a way to be pushed out of what eventually became the Power Five.
But it's also funny with Houston is that right around the corner is the urbaner campus, which is Texas Southern, right? And like the inextricable link between those two schools and everything else, like when they come together. But I want to talk to you about the Bagman story, because I thought it was so interesting when it came out, because it was so decidedly human, right? Like, I think that the part of that story is like, yeah, okay, these guys are dropping off money, right? And they're talking to this one person and they're going to this person. But then you had the things where it was like, well, we might be able to help you get your brother out of jail, right? Like, we can make a couple phone calls here. Like, the reach of what the booster can do goes so far beyond just money.
I haven't read the story in a long time, and I was on the train into the city today and I picked it back up. And the one that I love the most after 5 years is getting the tractor fixed.
Yes.
Because if you're from a part of the country where you understand how much tractors cost, again, in the interest of transparency, I put my ignorance in that article where I said, why don't you just buy the dude a tractor? And the guy looked at me and he goes, do you know how much tractors cost? Do you know how much attention that would draw? You can do 8 Camaros for a tractor. But yeah, this entire economy exists in a much more mundane way than people realize. And that's what we wanted to hammer home. The thing we got the most attention for in that article was, one, deciding to do it. 2, not playing hall monitor, or as I call it, merit badge media. I borrowed that from Andy Staples, and then I kind of turned it into a thing because it's been very combative in college football media. I must have missed that course where we're supposed to uphold the bylaws.
Right.
I mean, all I see is a really shaky corporation on very, very shaky ground in terms of their future. And to me, that's more newsworthy. So with this culture, we decided to do it. That was the big thing. And then we immediately decided, well, let's find out what we can get. But what we found was boring. And we said, well, let's demystify it then. And what I mean by boring is everyone's perception is SMU in the 80s and then Miami in the 80s and Nevin Shapiro. That's what everybody kind of rolls in together. That's
right.
What fan bases from particular cultures, like, you know, I'm just going to throw one out there, Michigan, would have you believe is so toxic about it. And the reality is this. The overwhelming amount of the individuals that the NCAA terms as student athletes are living near or below the poverty line. They grew up in completely different financial circumstances than most of us. And the favor economy, right, or the gesture economy, whatever you want to call it, is how they come to learn and interact with these university cultures.
Right.
Someone made a really good point to me one time that in the places I've covered the most, which is the poorest parts of the United States of America and the most segregated, that these communities would almost – never, certain pockets of these communities would never interact if not for college sports, specifically for this one reason. You see very, very rich white people going into very, very poor black communities and asking, essentially going hat in hand, if you will.
Right.
Where else does that exist in the world?
Right.
It doesn't.
Right. And they're going in kind of like, so who's the person I need to talk to? Right.
That's the hardest thing.
You know, and that's what it is, because you have all these assistant coaches and there's always the one guy, right, whose job it is to know who the people are to talk to. But when you're going into some place that you're not familiar with, the first question you need to ask to figure out how to get this done is, like, who runs things around here? And then you go through that person. That gets you to the next
step. And the more questions you ask, the better the chance you're going to get busted doing it.
Yes.
Or you spend a lot of good money after bad, let's say it that way.
Yeah.
You better know them early on. We wrote about that in the original piece, and I've covered that extensively. The earlier you establish the relationships, be it with the family, with the community, however that particular individual's actual family is structured or his high school family is structured, whoever is raising him, whoever is around him, the earlier you know and earn the trust of those individuals, the more likelihood of your money being successful
right.
in wooing him to a particular place.
Right. And this is kind of like every other quasi-legal business where you are thinking you're dealing with ultimately untrustworthy people, but trust is the grease that makes this whole engine go, right?
Absolutely.
Like especially when you start talking about transferring money, that money's going into probably one person's hands, who's then going to another person's hands, who's then going to another person's hands, dot, dot, dot. And then at some time, lowercase t equals capital T, it gets to where it is. But the only way this works is if everybody has trust down that chain.
You've got to have multiple people between you, the actual football player, and you need multiple people away from anyone associated with the university. When those things do not happen, when you actually hear about duffel bags and Mercedes-Benz trunks opening and all that nonsense, those are the stories you read about because those are idiots doing it. Because,
right.
because they saw a movie and they're replicating that when in actuality, it's just much more boring. You know what's funny is I wrote this story before Venmo,
mm-hmm.
and I imagine it's a whole different culture now because we focus on the $5,000, $10,000, $50,000 payments before a kid signs. There's a whole – I wrote about it. It's maintenance culture. It's just like if you're listening to this and you've been in college or had a kid in college, you know what I'm talking about. I need $100 for this. I need
right.
to – like, you know, the window motor in my car is broken. Mom, I need – that person, that bag man, this nefarious guy ends up being that for a lot of these kids. And so it's a lot of $100 handshakes but not really in a glamorous way. It's more like, hey, this – you know, I need an oil change. I need $50 to eat this weekend.
Right.
You've got to arrange that meeting.
Right. And football is different than basketball, where basketball, you got like the shoe economy and everything that's around there. Like there's more like legitimate business that sends the money in this way. Football is a much more DIY sort of setup where you really have people who love this football so much that they're willing to endanger their own freedom and break the law to give people money again that they would never give a dime to the people that they don't want their tax dollars going to.
Correct. Exactly. It's not right. It's bizarre, but it's examining those relationships is the most unique thing I've ever done in my career because you're right. We're not crossing the tracks. We're not crossing socioeconomic. We are crossing worlds. And I think I can't say that enough whenever I get into a national platform like this. If you haven't been to some of these places, and it's not just one city or one state, you know this,
right.
like it's in Southern California, it's in Texas, it's in Florida, it's in Atlanta, it's all over the country, Chicago for that matter. I'll jump back for a second. The shoe economy in basketball ended up being their undoing as we're watching now because what you did is you had a corporate, you had a centralized structure. It's much like the way that we write about and the way the government profiles terrorists. Again, I don't want to feed into this image of the bag man as an evil person necessarily, but when it's decentralized, right, when there's not a hub where you can intercept this information, which is it's amazing to read about Nike and Adidas and how sloppy they got.
Right.
It's a lot harder. It's whack-a-mole. And so also the bottom line is one basketball player changes an entire university, right? How many football players do you need to change the culture and the complexion of a football team in the Power Five?
Oh, you know, you need a bunch of them. Like you are an old
year after year.
Like you're an Ole Miss grad, and they had that great year, right? When they brought all those dudes in. Was it Tunsil, Kim DJ, Treadwell, I think was in that class, all of that.
Magic.
And here we stand, and it's like it never happened.
Exactly. But here's the great thing about Power Five football. For as hard as that hammer came down from the NCAA, from what they were actually able to prove in the kangaroo court situation deal, and they had the other schools ratting on them, and they were paying off kids to say this, or, you know, allegedly.
Right.
Ole Miss could do it all over again next year.
Yes.
I mean, that's, like, they didn't change anything.
No.
And I sat there when they were reading off the stuff in their fake court or whatever, and I've done this since, and, you know, at North Carolina, and anything that involves inducement, I always try and draw the line to. I'm not talking about what happened to Baylor, but this mission statement that they're going to beat this thing into submission is never going to happen, man. It's never, ever going to happen, okay?
Can't stop money.
Well, the dollar is so much bigger now. And you know, honestly, I don't want to tip my hand or anything, but I look now at these facilities that we're building, right? These kids show up on campus, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's holograms and waterfalls, right? All that does is show them
that there's money here.
Where their work is going.
Right.
And I, you know, every campus I go to, it doesn't matter how much money they have or don't have, Sun Belt, Big Ten, whatever. Let me show you our building. Man, what do I want to see your building for?
Right.
I've been in a locker room. It's fine. It's all great. You've got a different version of leather and a new flat screen and whatever. This one folds out or whatever. In the process of hiding the money, the smarter kids are now looking around and going, oh, damn, like, I paid for a lot here.
Yeah.
I paid for a whole lot.
Well, that's what Jalen said about being at Michigan is when they started going overseas and they started seeing their jerseys. And that's, they were like, oh, wait a minute. Somebody's getting paid here and we're not. And when you talk about nothing stopping, like with Ole Miss, when SMU paid Chad Morris that $4 million, I was like, guys, they're not doing this just to try. right? Like this is a school. And I think he's been on probation like 8 times or something like that through the course of time. Like they're at the top of the dean's list on getting on probation because they want to win so bad, but they're not big enough to actually pull it off. And so they had to go low for a good 20 years. And I don't know what they're doing right now. I just know that they did not pay a coach that much money just to cross their fingers and see how it would go.
Well, college football hates a usurper.
Yes.
So you have multiple entities in college football that enforce that unwritten rule. So you have the NCAA that doesn't like it. You have the leagues themselves that don't like it. And then you have the power structures that come out of these major entities. You could rattle off the first 20 names that you think of. That's who I'm talking about. None of them are going to abide by the middle of the pack schools reaching up. And at least it, now.
And that's what happened to Ole Miss.
Achieving dominance is one thing temporarily. Moving yourself truly, we talk about this all the time at Banner Society, truly changing the complexion of your program and becoming an Oregon, it's so rare. And Oregon did it because of the swoosh,
right?
And that was still moving heaven and earth.
And don't forget, they came for Oregon, the Willie Lyle situation.
Absolutely.
Like they, it was still a, hey, wait a minute, guys, this isn't supposed to happen.
Hey, man, any fortress you show me that's been built in the last 30 years, I can show you where the dirty labor was on that bad boy. And that's what people are asking me, like, oh, okay, well, you went to Ole Miss, you know, are you cover the SEC? You live in Nashville, so it must be Tennessee. It must be Florida. I said, yo, it's everybody.
Yeah.
It's everybody, man. It doesn't work without this. This is how you have to do it, and that's not to speak ill of it. It's just this is the function. These kids, to their credit, are now more aware at an earlier age of the function of things in this sport, and I think that's a good thing, honestly.
I think the new level of this for me is going to be like who are the new University of Houstons that are going to pop up? Like, for example, Georgia State is now like they've built an alumni base. This is going – and they want to be good at football.
And everybody laughed when they took on that lease for Turner Field, right? Everybody said – so I grew up a Georgia Southern fan. My parents went to school in Statesboro, and they said that commuter school, the teacher school – what are they? They're buying the Braves Stadium. What are they doing? Starting to work, right? Because you create a location, you create an identity, and all of a sudden these kids, East Point, College Park, wherever, all the way, I mean, even Marietta, doesn't matter. And I don't want to leave town. I don't want to drive 4 hours away or get recruited by Minnesota or one of those guys, right? What's the difference?
And Atlanta's the new South Florida, and what South Florida was in the 1980s in terms of population boom.
Yes.
And now suddenly you have all these players. Because, I mean, the state of Georgia's producing something like what exorbitant number of 4-star recruits now. And campus, so many of them go to Georgia, right? So many of them get into Georgia Tech.
The rate of growth in Georgia has been more pronounced than anywhere else, right? Because Florida's been consistent. Texas, at California, all those schools we talk about. And then you have the disproportionate ones. So Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi. West Tennessee, if it was its own state, would look like that as well. Georgia's the one because of everything that you just talked about, the population growth. And also, I just think the health of the city of Atlanta, that's the one where we've seen the biggest uptick. And also styles of ball that are played there too. I mean, there's a lot of good high school coaching.
Yeah. And you see it also happening in Florida too, with South Florida and Central Florida, like in Florida Atlantic even. They're just like, yo, we have so many good football players here. We can get a few of them, right? Like we can make something happen.
It's a very old argument of why. I mean, why are you seeing 4-star wide receivers from Apopka playing for Wisconsin? That's a hell of a sell, dude. That's a sell I ain't buying. I mean, I'm just saying. Like, and so these schools like South Florida, Central Florida, Houston, all of those American Athletic schools and Sun Belt schools that are now kind of considered to be the usurpers. What's the ceiling there? Actually, here's the better question. I'm gonna be honest with you. How much are the powers that be going to tolerate that?
Right.
That's the biggest thing. Because if the Big Ten starts losing money wholesale, or if these powers in the South, if this affects them in some way, which right now it doesn't because you're right, Alabama, Georgia, they get to go in and get the cream of the crop. They're not worried about it. You only get 22 at a time anyway. But if it starts to affect some of those larger revenue-generating conferences, I think you'll see them step in.
Right. Now, I want to get back to you. You talked about like the idea of doing that story and demystifying the idea of the bag man. What interested me about just the idea of the bag man is you as a guy deciding, yeah, I'm going – like this is my job in this ecosystem. This is what I want to be like. What drew guys to decide that they wanted to be the ones that were actually involved in making it happen?
Oh, man. They do follow a pattern, right? If I'd rattle it off right now, they're almost always native born to wherever they're doing this for, right? So I grew up kind of all around the country. I would probably be ruled out unless I had a ridiculous amount of money just because it goes back to, oh, who's your mom know? Who's, you know, oh, your dad's folks, or, you know, your people, right? Any culture where they use the word people in that connotation. All white, all 30 at the, I'd probably say the youngest 36, 37. I'm 38 years old. I don't know anybody that's my age that does it. It was always guys. When I did the story, it was guys about 10 years older than me at the time, so 5 years ago, all the way up until their 70s and 80s, obviously. So they have a lot of money. I mean, look, man, here's the deal. In all these small towns across Texas and the Southeast and even the Midwest, You make money selling insurance. You make money selling, I don't care what it is, jet skis, you're a dentist, what have you. What do you do? What do you do in America these days? You buy a lake house, you buy a house at the beach, something like that. You got three cars. Then what? You're bored. I think a lot of these people crave identity and authority. It's a tale as old as time in that way. So if you're from one of these small towns in the South, what's equity in those worlds? We know this, right? The whole college football is a religion and all that. So how do you affect the religion? How do you gain importance? Well, you're not a football coach. You're not an athletic director or anything like that. This is how you feel important.
Yeah.
And the ability to purchase that by paying a human being, and I use the word purchase with all the connotation associated with it, because I'm going to be really honest with you. This is far from the ideal way to get these kids money.
Right.
And I don't say that enough when I talk about that story. This is a lopsided relationship, okay, where a lot of bad things can happen to the individuals who receive this money. And I would also like to point out, if you're talking about paying a kid, let's just say an arbitrary amount of $15,000 to $20,000, and I usually hear things that operate in that range, that compared to their market value and what they generate, if you're talking about a Power 5 school or something in the Southeastern Conference, give me a break, man.
Yeah.
Grossly underpaid.
Yeah, it's funny. When we talked to Marcus Spears about it, he talked about being in schools. He'd be like, yeah, the boosters come around off your little money here and there. He's like, but we realized that wasn't free, right?
No.
That once you do that, they own you. Like SMU was interesting because their cheating was so flagrant that the players own the program. But in most cases, it's vice versa.
SMU serves as a test case. So does Miami. Every time someone gets in trouble, this is a learning ecosystem, okay? So if you think about it all as one giant organism, they sort of look and react. And I don't know if you remember the SI story about Oklahoma State a couple years ago. A lot of the guys I talked to at the different schools, and I still talk to some of these guys, some of these bagmen, they didn't believe that Oklahoma State story because the idea, there were like anecdotes of handing out envelopes in the locker room after the game. No, man, because what's that going to do? You handing out everybody an envelope?
Right.
Is it orange slices after the game? It's not, right? So you can't do that. The bounty system was one thing that went away with pretty quick, to be honest. I know that that gets a ton of attention when it comes out in the media, but I've never heard of, seen, had anyone tell me on or off the record that a bounty system was in place. It's hard to enforce.
Right.
Also, kids get mad. If kids get hurt and they lose their earning potential, what are they going to do? They're going to talk.
Right.
So, the best thing to do is splinter any kind of central authority. All of the structures I've seen, there were three schools in the SEC that I used for that piece. They all had the same thing where it was, you're from town X. This is close or from where kid Y is from. We're going to give you these three or four kids. You're going to take care of them. Then they also have a guy that you can call in the university town if there's a problem, something that needs to be taken care of.
Right.
It's decentralized for a reason. So it's not what you would see in the third act of a film, right? It's just not. And people get really frustrated when I say that.
Right. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, we talk about like what is in it for these guys. Like this sounds to me, it's like an extension of what the message board culture has been, right? Like
sure.
It's just like people love the idea of I'm somebody who knows something. Like I'm fascinated by premium. I would love to write something about the people on premium message boards. There's just no way to do it without giving away who they are. People want that place in the ecosystem that badly, basically.
Absolutely. Media, once media became interactive, you and I know this, right? There was no looking back. You couldn't, right? You had to assume a three-dimensional sort of media profile. And, I mean, that's why when people talk – this is the only media job in the world, unless I miss something on CNN or Fox or something. Like I don't know of a Capitol Hill reporter that goes and says one thing one way or the other about the president, and someone goes, oh, of course. They went to Bama. Like, that only happens in my – like, that's – like, people are Googling my parents' home address in college football media. Like that, this is the only culture that, where that kind of stuff happens. And it comes directly from, I would say, that message board celebrity, but also like message board activism.
Yes.
Because you can fake it for a long time on these online cultures and you can rabble rouse extremely well. I have this theory that every single thing the political media and the political culture is experiencing, college football and some sports, we were about 6 or 7 years ahead of you on this. So if you want to ask us how bad it can get, we'll let you know, okay? But this, like, activation of angry social media user, bro, we've been dealing with that for, like, 15 years now, man. I mean, the internet, as far as I'm concerned, in my corner of the world, was invented for somebody to scream at me about sports.
Right. The other thing about the bagman that was interesting in that story is the mentality of these guys where they really feel like they're doing something good. Like, the one guy who talked about, like, it's not the money I can give, it's the things that I can do. And he seemed, like, for better or worse, really proud of himself for the contribution he was making to the larger society.
Absolutely, man. Civil rights. I'm dead serious. Yeah, absolutely. They're not wrong in a vacuum. I will say this. I did come across a couple instances where it was clear that the player in question, I have to do mental gymnastics, not to use the phrase student athlete, because it drives me nuts because it doesn't exist. It's not real. the athlete, the football player in question, was on his way out and was not going to be that much more effective, and they were still chipping off money for the guys. I was actually shocked to see that because I kind of thought it was just you kind of feed them dollars as they go up, and if it's a bad investment, you walk away. But they're smart, and I wrote about that at the very end of that story where you have to keep the circle going, right? This is what physical education degrees are for, is that these guys go back to their community. You know, the guy who was the three-star who didn't make it, who was the undersized defensive back or what have you, he becomes defensive coordinator at that high school where he came from, and thus the process continues. And then you use him as the conduit for the next kid.
Right.
So they do feel like they are patrons. They do feel like they're doing something charitable, for right. sure. Absolutely.
Well, that was the interesting thing about Sherwood Blood and SMU, the infamous line, we've got a payroll to meet. Because yes. for people who don't realize, that what got SMU the death penalty, it wasn't so much that they got caught paying players. It's that they got caught paying players and then said, we're going to keep paying them according to the exact same scheme because we have a payroll to meet, right? Deal's a deal.
Really? Look, man, they honored their – I look at that and I laugh and I'm like, hey, man, that's honest business.
A deal is a deal.
It's kind of contrasts half of what was going on in Dallas in the 80s where right. I was like, okay, no, they held up to it. Yep. You know? Well, what were the kids going to do, take them to court for breach? I was shocked. But I can tell you why they did that. You know why they did that? Because they thought they were going to get out of it.
Yep.
And that's why they got the death penalty. Before television was so powerful that it essentially took the teeth out of the death penalty, they gave them the death penalty because by saying we've got a payroll to meet, what they meant was we need to maintain these relationships because the next class and the next class, these moms, uncles, high school coaches, community leaders, whatever, in whatever part of Texas we need to go to, they need to know that if we say we're going to pay, we're going to pay.
Right.
That's why they did it.
Again, the honor of underground, like underground stuff only works on the basis of trust or threats, yes. right? And there are only but so many threats that people can issue. Like the dope game works on trust because people trust that you're going to get killed, right? Like, you show up late, you don't get what you're supposed to get.
You make
trust.
Concessions immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like that part is understood. But on this one, everybody just has to believe that everybody is going to do the things that they said. And the only way you do that is by doing those things over and over again, repeated iterations.
Well, you touch on something too, because one of the things that we've done in America from Prohibition on through the crack cocaine in the 80s is as we in the media and then Hollywood comes in behind us, we turn these into character arcs, like the whole modern anti-hero. This stuff that I do where a guy's given $500 to a running back and then he gets to go tell his buddies about it on the golf course, even though he's not supposed to, right?
Right.
This is armchair gangster. This is PG gangster. Nobody gets shot. This is the thing where you get that thrill. It's like guys who go play paintball.
Right.
I mean, that's sorry. Like, I was raised by cops, and so I was like guys are like, all right, man, we're going to go play paintball this weekend. Like, that's what this is. Like, I got to go meet this kid and drop $500 off. Like, okay, all right. Well, you're not going to get murdered or anything like that. But they paint the culture with the same colors that it is. First off, none of this is illegal, by the way. I always have to say that up front.
Right. It's not illegal. It's not illegal until they decide to put something on the books like North Carolina did with agents after right. they got caught up.
Yeah. But handing a kid $500 in your local college town is not illegal in and of itself. The NCAA processes that to a point in their messaging over and over again where this is a bylaw violation if proven by an NCAA committee, which is their version of a court. That's right. All it is, man.
Right. And all this stuff is funny to me because when people ask the question when I say that players should be paid, they're like, well, where's the money supposed to come from? Where it comes from right now.
Buddy.
There are all these people who are begging for the privilege of giving this money away.
Again, I'm not in the business of tipping off what I'm working on next. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about $100 million athletic departments. Not just one, right? Not just five anymore. And then a bunch of $80 million athletic departments. Well, they don't have that many employees, man. I didn't go to business school, but I've learned, like, you got $80 million on your budget, and you only have 20 employees.
They're not taking all the money home.
Oh, no. The secretary answering the phone is not bringing down 1.5. Okay.
Right.
So every year, they're faced with a conundrum of we got to get rid of this money. Is there another business that works like this in America? I'm strapped to think of it, honestly.
No, there's none, right? Another thing, because college football budgets, the other part that's fun is they're so heavily subsidized by donations. Like, you can go through and you'll see the lot of 25-30% of the budget is people just giving them money.
Yeah.
But nobody knows where to get the money
from.
Well,
most of the head coaching salaries, I think people don't know this or it bears repeating, is that – so let's say you're coaching – you're talking about Chad Morris getting $4 million a year. Most states – because these guys are state employees, most states have a cap on the actual financial or the salary that they can pay these guys.
Right.
So like Chad Morris, for instance, and I'm just making this up, but this exists in multiple states where Chad Morris, I think, is compensated something like $110,000 by the state of Arkansas.
Right.
The other 3.9 whatever comes from the it's usually something like the Razorback Foundation or one of those deals. Yeah. It's look, man, it's a fun way to hide money from the government. It's a fun way to hide money from athletes. This is a big game to them, man. That's all it is.
And this is the fun stuff that nobody really wants to talk about because we sell a charade, right? Yes. Even though I swear this, I don't see how this wouldn't be more marketable.
What, this part of it?
Yeah, just all of it. It's so much more fun.
I'll say something on the air I've never said before. Story came out in 14. I get flown out to LA like 6 times over the course of a year. You probably know where this is going, right? So they're like, we want you to meet this producer who's really interested in your story. We're going to turn it into a TV show. We're going to turn it into a movie and all this stuff, right? There exists a divide in this country, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, so strong that to me it's a mirror of everything that goes on. I would get to these meetings, and they'd be the fancy meetings out, the fancy LA meetings, right, where they'd be like, no, we really think this is an amazing story. Great, okay. We just have one problem, okay? We don't believe it. We don't believe the motivation. Why would someone give? Is it their own money? I'm like, yeah. How much? I don't know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000. Yeah, that just doesn't make sense to us. We couldn't make a TV show or a movie about someone who just gave money just because he wanted his college football team to win more games. And I sit there and I'm like, what do I say? Like, how, if there's an old saying about pro wrestling, for those who believe, no explanation is necessary, right? For those who do not believe, no explanation will do. And that's kind of how you talk about how more people are not interested in this aspect of it. I think people just don't believe, right? They cannot believe this. It's a little harder, man, when you're from like 100 miles up from New York and you go to one of these private liberal arts schools and you like, you know, you're not really forking out money for the lacrosse team to do this kind of stuff. You either understand this culture, you don't. It's not about belief. You just know, or it's the most foreign concept in the world.
When I tell people about college sports, the farther you get away from people who are in the weeds on it, the crazier it sounds to people. Like when you go try to explain to somebody from another country, just the whole notion of what college sports is, they're like, wait a minute, no. So they're in school? Kinda. Like it's the wildest thing. And when you're so deep in it, you don't think about it. But when you go tell people who don't follow this at all that the players aren't paid, they're like, really? That doesn't make any sense.
I always like to do that with the British because you don't have the language, you don't have the language barrier. And I had an English friend that my wife and I invited to our wedding in Louisiana and it was,
oh God, I'd pay money for his impressions.
You just start, well, I mean, aside from all the Louisiana of
yes.
it, he works in sports over in England and we compare notes all the time and he still to this day goes, all right, tell me how it's set up again. Like he can't even get before you even get to this weird part of it, he can't even understand the structure of some of these schools have teams, some of them don't. But, you know, how are they making this? Why are they on television then? Like, this very much isn't only in America type culture. We say that a lot, but this really is.
That is Stephen Godfrey. Check him out, Banner Society, who is doing this series with us and greatly appreciate it. Check him out at SBNation.com. Also, did you ever do the Ole Miss book?
No, man, I need to. I need to. Wait, I got to wait for a couple NDAs to die.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be honest with you. I've had some people before be like, hey, man, I'd love to talk to you. Give me 5 years. I legit had somebody say, I'm going to need about 5 years from you. I'm like, all right, okay.
Well, I'm ready for it because that is a fascinating whole realm of things at Ole Miss. Quietly, like, making itself one of the more liberal institutions in the SEC because they have no other choice. They are fighting ghosts like nobody
else.
Buddy,
you got 50 miles ahead of you. You better start running to catch up. You and I are going to be long dead before they think about doing that.
They're trying.
Oh, man. Are they?
Hey, man, I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thank you to Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society for joining us in our latest installment of our sideline series on college football booster culture. The next installment will be with Joel Anderson of Slate. We're going to put a link to Stephen's story about the bag man in the show notes of the podcast. Also, thanks to our sponsor, ButcherBox. Be sure to check out the Mina Kimes show featuring Lenny, her dog. She chats with Booger McFarland about Niners Seahawks in the biggest games of Week 10 in the NFL. Be sure to check out the Mina Kimes show. Also, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.